killjoy. The Senate will please come back to order. The first order of business is reports from standing committees. If the reading clerk would please.
February the 3rd, 2015, Mr. President, your committee number one, Judiciary, to whom was referred Senate File 115, Discrimination, reports back with a recommendation that it do pass. I, Senators Christensen, Esquivel, Kinsey, Von Fladern, no, Senator Hicks, Senator Christensen, Chairman.
I think that's it. We're ready. Mr. Majority Floor Leader, that does clear the desk. Bring us to bills on general file.
Thank you, Mr. President. Mr. President, I move the Senate resolve itself back into committee of the whole to discuss bills on general file.
You have all heard the motion. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. That motion has been adopted. Senator Hastert.
Here we go. Down to.
Committee of the Whole will come back to order. The next bill for our consideration is Senate File 137. The reading clerk will read the bill.
Senate File 137, Farm License Plate, sponsored by Senator Meyer. It was referred to Committee Number 8, Transportation, Highways, Military Affairs, who reports back with a favorable recommendation that it do pass. I, Senators Anderson, O2, Emmerich, Esquivel, Johnson, and Meyer, Senator Meyer, Chairman.
You've heard the reading of the bill. What is your pleasure, Senator Meyer?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, I move in the committee the whole rise and report it do so with a do pass motion on Senate File 137, Farm License Plates. Mr. Chairman, what this bill does is add some clarity to the treasurers across the counties that have been interpreting this statute in various different ways. And what it specifically says down on page 2, lines 21 and 22, is that distinctive license farm stickers shall be issued by the county treasurer upon request. And again, over on page 3, line 6, it says that farm stickers shall bear the inscription farm. And the amending words are farm stickers, and the shall be issued upon request. The reason for that, Mr. Chairman, is simply is that some treasurers are interpreting that differently, where they won't issue them. Other treasurers interpret it the way the statute had been interpreted previously, and they do issue them. And so what this bill is just clarifies that and makes it so the county treasurers are going to basically do their job. Yeah.
Further discussion on the bill?
All right.
Thank you. Ready for the question? All those in favor of Senator Meyer's motion, when the committee as a whole rises to report, it do so with a favorable recommendation on Senate File 137. Please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed? Senate File 137 has passed committee as a whole. The next bill for our consideration is Senate File 84. The reading clerk will read the bill.
Senate File 84, Enhanced Recovery Carbon Dioxide Certification, sponsored by Senator Von Fladern. It was referred to Committee Number 9, Minerals, Business, and Economic Development, who reports back with a favorable recommendation that it do pass. Aye, Senators Anderson, 28. Cole, Cooper, Rothfuss, Von Fladern, Senator Cooper, Acting Chairman.
You've heard the reading of the bill. What is your pleasure? Senator Cooper.
Mr. Chairman, I move that when the committee of the whole rise and reports that do so with a recommendation that Senate File 84, enhanced recovery carbon dioxide certification do pass. Mr. Chairman, there are no standing committee amendments, and at this time I'd like you to, if you would, please call on Senator Von Fladen for an explanation of the bill.
Senator Von Fladen.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This bill, Senate File 84, allows the Wyoming Oil and Gas Commission to voluntarily, if somebody asks them, voluntarily ask them to calibrate how much and certify how much CO2 has been sequestered in a formation in an enhanced oil recovery, EOR, operation. So originally we had sequestration statutes which said if you were permanently storing CO2, then you had to follow X, and we wrote new statutes and we said who the pore space owner was and so forth. But we've been doing enhanced oil recovery since the early 70s. But a little bit of residual CO2, not a lot, but a little bit stays down in the formation and never comes back out. What this does is up front allow them to give their business plan and their geological studies, everything to the Wyoming Oil and Gas Commission, and the Wyoming Oil and Gas Commission can then certify that, yes, their calculations, or not certify, their calculations of 1%, 0.5%, 3% are being sequestered. This would come into play in the future more than it does today because there's only one person actually doing, there's actually two operations doing CO2 enhancement. But what this would do in the future is allow somebody like a power station that wanted to sell it, if we ever learn how to scrub well enough to clean the CO2 out, that wants to sell their CO2 to somebody or give it to somebody so they can get a CO2 credit for having lowered their emissions levels. This will allow them up front to say, we have 1%, 3%, or in the case of a sequestration project, X percent. But this is only enhanced oil recovery. That's all this is covering. This is not going into sequestration, but it is allowing for some credit for some of the CO2 that never comes back out. I ask for your favorable vote on this one.
Any further discussion? Question? Are you ready for the question? Question being called. All those in favor of Senator Cooper's motion, when the Committee of the Whole rises to report, it do so with a favorable recommendation on Senate File 84, say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. Senate File 84 is passed Committee of the Whole. The next bill for our consideration is Senate File 102. Reading clerk will read the bill.
Senate File 102, Medical Billing Provisional Provider, sponsored by Senator Landon. It was referred to Committee Number 10, Labor, Health, and Social Services. Reports back with a favorable recommendation that it do pass amended. Aye, Senators Kraft, Driscoll, Landon, Peterson, and Scott. Senator Scott, Chairman.
You've heard the reading of the bill. What is your pleasure, Senator Scott?
Mr. Chairman, I move in the Committee of the Whole rise and report to do so with the recommendation that Senate File 102 do pass. Mr. Chairman, there was a standing committee amendment, I believe.
Yes.
I ask it be read in at this time.
Senate File 102, Standing Committee Amendment Number 1, page 2, line 14.
Senator Scott.
Mr. Chairman, I move adoption of the Standing Committee Amendment, and for an explanation of both the Standing Committee Amendment and the bill, I yield to Senator Landon, sponsor of the bill.
Senator Landon.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This is, fellow senators, a bill that follows a bill that was passed out of the Senate a year ago. It's a little bit of a cleanup bill, but it does, I think, require a little bit of explanation dating back to what was then Senate File 89 of a year ago. And I do that for the newer members of our Senate, but also just as a reminder, senators, as to why we ran Senate File 89. You'll recall that back then we had a conversation about our mental health professionals, and prior to the passage of 89 last year, those mental health professionals were having to find a physician who would sign off on their Medicaid billing of patients. The more we looked into it, the more we realized that the industry standard was really way past that. And so what I've done in terms of background beyond that, fellow senators, I have provided you with the reasoning behind Senate File 89 of a year ago. That should be in your bins. I think that that will be a good reminder and a good good catch-up for those who did not sit through the debate. You'll remember we had some very compelling testimony in committee, and we talked about it here on the floor, that a lot of our mental health professionals, we had one mental health professional, for example, in the Mother County, who was having to drive all the way to Casper to find a physician to sign off on her billings for Medicaid. And in that particular case, it really wasn't even a physician who had any background in mental health services. So that bill went out of here with a very major endorsement from this body. And I am happy to report, senators, out of our Medicaid office over at the Department of Health, that Senate File 89 did exactly as we hoped it would. It has streamlined some processes. I think it's increased the access to mental health services, particularly in our rural areas, and it has had no impact, none, no impact on the Medicaid billing over there. I've also provided you with a detailed analysis from that licensing area of the Department of Health, not to bog you down in those numbers, but just so that you can reference that to get an idea of all of those mental health professionals out there. So, Mr. Chairman, that's a quick background that we can revisit if we need to. What Senate File 102 does, the meat of the bill goes to page 2, and what we're doing, we missed this in the conversation last year, but if one of those mental health professionals wants to hire an individual who is working toward that 3,000 hours of certification, the provisional licensee working for that mental health professional would still have to jump past the mental health professional and try to find a physician to sign off on work that they're doing, which really doesn't make any sense. And so what the language does, as you can see, is that we added that these services are furnished by a licensed mental health professional. Authorized services shall include services provided by a person holding a provisional license as a mental health professional if the services are provided under the supervision of a licensed mental health professional. Now, that's where the amendment comes in, Mr. Chairman, and in the Standing Committee amendment, we have, I believe, tightened that up just a little bit. Hopefully you would agree with that. We changed that to supervision, so that person does have to have some direct supervision from the mental health professional. That is the Standing Committee amendment, and I would either be glad to answer any questions or call for the question on the Standing Committee amendment.
Any further discussion on the amendment? Seeing none, all those in favor of Standing Committee Amendment Number 1 to Senate File 102 signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. The amendment has Standing Committee Amendment Number 1 to Senate File 102 has passed. We're back on the bill.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. That essentially is the bill, fellow senators. I'd be glad to answer any questions. Essentially what we're doing is if somebody is working in the office of a mental health professional, working toward those hours, that billing is something that the mental health professional can take care of. As I say, if you look at the information provided for the fiscal note, which was not included with the bill, you'll see that there really is no projected impact with what we're doing here. We're just trying to get out of the way of some bureaucracy. Be glad to answer any questions. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Any further discussion on the bill? Seeing none, the question was called. All those in favor of Senator Scott's motion, when the Committee of the Whole rises to report, it do so with a favorable recommendation on Senate File 102, say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. Senate File 102 has passed Committee of the Whole. The next bill for our consideration is Senate File 142.
Senate File 142, Building Code Regulations, sponsored by Senator Driscoll. It was referred to Committee Number 7, Corporation Election Political Subdivision, who reports back with a favorable recommendation that it do pass amended. Aye, Senators Case, Hicks, Meyer, Pappas, and Scott. Senator Case, Chairman.
You've heard the reading of the bill. What is your pleasure? Senator Case.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. I move that when a committee of the whole rises to report it, do so with a do-pass recommendation on Senate File 142, Building Code Regulation. There is a standing committee amendment. I'd ask that it be read in at this time.
Senate File 142, Standing Committee Amendment Number 1, page 2, line 7.
Mr. Chairman, I would move Standing Committee Amendment Number 1 to Senate File 142, and for an explanation of the bill and to handle the amendment as well, I would yield to Senator Driscoll.
Senator Driscoll.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'll start with an explanation of the amendment to the bill. This Senate File 142 has to do with fire protection and restricting interpretation and enforcement of building codes. It has to do with, in a setting such as Frontier Days, Sturgis Bike Rally, whatever, guys rent their houses out. I'll go to the amendment and I'll finish explaining the bill. The amendment is on page 2, and it struck out line 7, which would be for periods of 31 days or less to be required. Under the most recently adopted version of the International Building Code, this type of use, and that part has been stricken. So it now has taken it out. In the past, it's been 31 days. It's now unlimited. What this bill really does is we'd run into some problems with people renting their houses out in towns and being able to not run into commercial regulations with the state fire code. And we actually had a town that pursued it, and it would mean that you'd have to put sprinkler systems in, fire doors, et cetera, change your residence on these short-term rentals. This bill merely makes it where if you go to provision A of it, it's a nice short bill that got shorter. No state or local official authorized to enforce the position of this article, interpret and enforce any building codes or standards adopted by the state that is more stringent or burdensome required by state standards or codes. This really codifies into law that you can keep your residence, use it as a residence. It does have the state fire marshal's neutral on it. They came out, they're neutral, so they're not a big problem with it. With that, I would move for adoption of the amendment.
We're on the amendment. Any further discussion on the standing committee amendment? Seeing none, all those in favor of Senator Case's motion to adopt standing committee amendment number 1 to Senate File 142, say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. If the amendment has passed, we're back on the bill.
If there's any more questions, otherwise I'll stand for the question.
Any further discussion on the bill? Senator Escobel.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I was just wondering, how would this affect, fair housing codes, employment, housing discrimination, that type of thing? Would they be covered?
Senator Driscoll.
Mr. Chairman, I can't answer that. I'll have it to you by the second reading.
Senator Von Flattern.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So for the sponsor, just a question. Could you actually now, you can go out and build rental property, townhouses and or detached, and not have to follow any of the sprinkler systems? Because they're all going to be rented less than 31 days. So if you put up a set of ski condos or something, would you not have to follow any of the codes for commercial? Because it doesn't differentiate between residents that you might live in full-time or something you give up for a week. It just says all townhouses and dwellings.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Case.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think the key to that is that we're only talking about short-term rental of detached one- and two-family dwellings and townhouses. We're not talking about rows of attached townhouses. And it's not that they wouldn't have to follow the building code, but they would not have to be regulated within that code for commercial use. They would still have to follow the building code, local authority, et cetera, but they wouldn't be to the standards of commercial use. And again, I emphasize it's detached, one- and two-family dwellings, so it's not big apartment complexes. It's not rows of townhouses abutting each other. These are isolated single-family and two-family homes.
Senator Pappas.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Basically, the issue here is that these facilities are one- and two-bedroom or two-dwelling townhomes, and if someone wants to rent a townhome for a period of time, you know, could be to the legislature. If we don't want that facility, which was designed as a residence, to be thought as a commercial thought of as a commercial property, and so and we've had some issues with building code officials believing that just because it's being rented and whoever owns it is making money, that it should become a commercial endeavor and should meet commercial building codes. No. The buildings were designed as residences and should stay as residences and don't have to meet building codes. Just because you rent it out and make a few bucks on it shouldn't drive you into a commercial business code. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Senator Scott.
Mr. Chairman, there was an earlier question, and if I heard it right, it was with regard to does this impact the fair housing statutes? And the answer is, and those are the ones that prohibit discrimination lending, the answer is it has no impact on those whatsoever. This has to do with building codes and does not affect that law and its operation.
Any further discussion? Senator Von Fladen.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Not to belabor it, but it doesn't really specify that it's not built for commercial reasons. So as long as they're not detached, they can still be built for commercial reasons, and as long as they don't rent for over 31 days. I think that's what the bill says.
Any further discussion? Seeing that, Senator Christensen.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And while it specifies international residential code, and the good senator from Cheyenne in the industry could correct me, but I think what they're clarifying is that it's to go with the residential code, not the building code, which is a commercial code, and applies to commercial buildings. When you go in and get your permits and it talks about uses and what the intent is and everything else, there's a difference between a residence and a commercial rental as far as apartments and so forth.
Senator Pappas.
Mr. Chairman, that's correct. However, please understand that the International Residential Code does not affect a lot of portions of the state. It's not been adopted by the State Fire Marshal's Office, but there are communities who have adopted it by home rule. So the language is still okay in here. It would affect those communities that do use the International Residential Code. If that clears up anything for you. Thank you.
Senator Driscoll.
Mr. Chairman, it's very clear that when you're building properties for commercial use, they do fall under state fire code, and the fire marshal comes in. If you're building condos or you're building townhouses, they don't care. If they're built for commercial use, you will submit to the state fire marshal, and that's what this does. It basically says if these are homes that are being used for incidental use, i.e., some incidental-type rentals, that type deal, they will be exempt. They can't come in and force them into the commercial status. You also tend to run into, as far as your the way our lodging tax runs, you're going to run into commercial use. If you start running long-term, you're going to run into a lot with local authorities. They've got a lot of means to kind of determine what commercial use is.
Any further discussion? Ready for the question? All those in favor of Senator Case's motion that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report it, do so with a favorable recommendation on Senate File 142, say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. Senate File 142 has passed Committee of the Whole. Mr. Majority Floor Leader.
Mr. Chairman, I move that the Committee of the Whole beg leave to rise and sit again.
You've heard the motion. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed? Motion passes. Mr. President.
Or at that order of business, reports from standing committees.
Oh, I remember. February the 3rd, 2015, Mr. President, your committee number 2 appropriation, to whom was referred Senate File 146, Spending Policy Amendments. Reports back with a recommendation that it do pass. Aye, Senators Hastert, Perkins, Ross, Wasserberger, excuse, Senator Burns, Senator Ross, Chairman. February the 3rd, 2015, Mr. President, your committee number 2, Appropriations, to whom was referred Senate File 67, Waiver Stabilization Trust Account. Reports back with a recommendation that it do pass failed in accordance with Senate Rule 5.4. Ayes, Senator Hastert. No, Senators Perkins, Ross, and Wasserberger. Excuse, Senator Burns, Senator Ross, Chairman. February the 3rd, 2015, Mr. President, your committee number 2, Appropriation, to whom was referred Senate File 141, State Budget Development. Reports back with a recommendation that it do pass. Aye, Senators Hastert, Perkins, Ross, Wasserberger, excuse, Senator Burns. February the 3rd, 2015, Mr. President, your committee number 3, Revenue, to whom was referred Senate File 122, Vision 2020. Reports back with a favorable recommendation that it do pass. Aye, Senators Case, Driscoll, Kinski, Landon, and Peterson. Senator Peterson, Chairman.
Senator Peterson.
Thank you, Mr. President. I'm trying to find my notes, that bill that was just read in.
File, which one was the vision?
At a fiscal note.
Vision 2020. 122.
Senate File 122 had a fiscal note, and I'd ask for that Senate File 122 to be referred to committee number 2, Appropriations.
Without objection, Senate File 122, the Vision 2020 is re-referred to Appropriations Committee. Any other messages? Mr. Majority Floor Leader, that clears the desk to or at that order of business is a general file.
Thank you, Mr. President. Mr. President, I move the Senate resolve itself back into Committee of the Whole to discuss the last two bills on general file.
You heard the motion. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. That motion has been adopted.
Committee of the Whole is back in order. Next bill for our consideration is Senate File 141. The reading clerk will read the bill.
Senate File 141, State Budget Development, sponsored by Senator Nicholas. It was referred to Committee Number 2, Appropriation. Reports back with a favorable recommendation that it do pass. Aye, Senator Hastert, Perkins, Ross, and Wasserberger. Excuse, Senator Burns, Senator Ross, Chairman.
You've heard the reading of the bill. What's your pleasure, Senator Ross?
Mr. Chairman, I move that when the Committee of the Whole rise and report to do so with a do pass recommendation on Senate File 141, State Budget Development. There are no standing committee amendments, and I yield the floor to the President of the Senate.
Mr. President.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, this bill does three separate things that deal with the budget. All the things are some things that we've done routinely, we've taken for granted over the years, and what we're doing is codifying these elements. The first item starts on page 2. You'll recall that when you that we provide by statute for a statutory reserve amount. When you look at your goldenrod, it is this item right here that says statutory reserve, the 5% of the general fund revenue. And this year it's about $109 million. So what that refers to, folks, is that in any budget, just like your checking account, you need to have an amount in your checking account so that as money's coming in and going out, there's always sufficient checks to write your checks out. So now, in this case, you do have to imagine that you're on an accrual system. And what's important with the accrual system is if you look at all those appropriations and all those expenditures, they do not, all the revenues don't come in before the expenditures. You've got big revenue months. So if you think about when you write your checks for the property taxes, if you split your checks, you got November, I think, and April. If you pay 100% of them at once, you've got in December. So the state government receives a lot of its income when property taxes are paid. The state government also receives a sales tax at uneven increments. We get more sales tax in the summer than we get in the winter months in general. Severance taxes comes at odd times. So when you look at the cash management of the government needs to have a reserve in its bank account, so it's writing checks out, and there's always a reserve there. And we've decided over time that that reserve should be 5% of the prior general fund of the general fund revenues, which is $109 million. Now, the statute that sets up the statutory reserve has provided does provide that it will provide for this at the time that the governor submits his budget. There is an anomaly in there that it does not explain whether or not the governor is required to also maintain that when he provides the supplemental budget. All this does is clarify that the statutory reserve is required to be maintained by the governor when he submits his budget, both in the time of the submits the biennial budget and the supplemental budget. When you turn over to the next page, and it actually goes over on page 4, the issue there is the spending policy reserve accounts, the SPRA accounts, and they are profiled on your goldenrods at page 5. So you've got the SPRA accounts. Now, the SPRA accounts were designed by statute not as a bank account to go to get monies. They were set up to provide for an investment policy. You recall that the investment policy is that we have a spending policy reserve amount that is 5%. We say that we will in general spend 5% of the income off of the permanent mineral trust fund as well as the common school permanent land fund. And if there are revenues in excess, they go into the 5%, they go from the general fund into the spending policy reserve accounts. That account then bills to the 75% figure, which is 75% of the SPA in reserve. When at the end of the fiscal year, if there are amounts in excess of the SPA cap, the dollars are then triggered and they move back into the corpus of the permanent mineral trust fund, or if it's the SPA for the common school permanent land fund, back into its corpus. You'll recall that is the inflation proofing, and all of this, the SPRA accounts were created at the time that then Treasurer Lummis encouraged, and we adopted a constitutional amendment to allow ourselves to invest into equities. And the idea with the equities is that you don't spend everything off of your equities, rather your capital gains get collected, 5% gets spent, so you have a continuous policy. The balance goes into the SPRAW account. And then on a year that you have less than the 5%, you can reach into the SPRAW account and pull that money out to bring your expenditures up to 5%. So it's a buffer account. If you make more than 5% from the general fund, it goes into the account. If you make less than 5%, you can pull out of the account. And then on those fantastic years or those extraordinary years where you collect more than the SPA 75% amount, you'll tip back into the corpus of the account. Now, this was an investment policy that at the time was taken from the Yale Trust. It was a tremendously successful long-term spending policy, and we've adopted it. So all this amendments do on this page is tell the governor that when you bring to us a balanced budget, the budget will not include as part of your operating revenues any part of these accounts. So, again, we're talking about, remember, we are the, by the Constitution, this body is the appropriating entity. But we, by statutes, direct the executive branch to provide budgets. And they have to be balanced budgets because we have to pass a balanced budget. And when we're directing as to the executive branch is when you bring that balanced budget in it, you're not entitled to use the SPRAW accounts to balance your budgets. Nor are you entitled to use, as I pointed out, the statutory reserve account. The third change you'll see over on page 5 of the document, and what this does is it codifies a practice that we've always believed in, and as chair of the Appropriations Committee, I would report to you was the law, and now we're going to make sure it is the law. You know, I might be leaving one day. I don't want you to forget. So, Mr. Chairman, what we say here is that when the agency, the process, as you know, is an agency makes a budget request, that gets published in a book, which is your budget books, which you all have, and there's a narrative of what they want to do with the request. Once the request is reviewed by the governor, he accepts or rejects, and he makes a recommendation whether the expenditure should be approved or disapproved. And that is the governor's rec. Then it goes to the Joint Appropriations Committee, and they either adopt, modify, or disapprove of the governor's recommendation with respect to that expenditure item. Now, the trick is that once it's approved, it goes into the budget. Now, when you flip over and you look at a typical budget on any page, I'm not sure they've all distributed, but when you see them, you're going to see that there's a line item, and this one happens to be vocational rehabilitation, $27 million, and of which is $5 million. And it may be that through the budget process, we added $100,000. Now, we do not specify what the $100 to be spent for. Sometimes we footnote things and say it's restricted to this. But generally, we add the footnotes, the JAC adds the footnotes to those areas where the governor made no recommendation because you need a narrative to describe why you added the money. But for the things that went through the normal budget process, there is no narrative. It just increases that dollar amount. So you add in $100,000 to $1 million budget, now you have $1.1 million of budget. Now, if you think about it, that makes the budget bill veto-proof. And the reason it's veto-proof is because the governor can't line item out the $100,000 line item. And we've done that deliberately. I mean, it's the way these budgets are designed to be kind of veto-proof. But if you also think about it, it is generally our view that the budget, once you approve the agency narrative and the governor approves it and it goes into the budget, the expenditure of those funds should be governed and are constrained by the narratives in the budgets. And by statute now, we're saying that is, in fact, the case. So we say that unless it's changed or modified by JAC or there's a footnote, then the narratives that were based, that the agency put together, asking for the money and the approval, constitute a binding parameter for which the auditors can go back and look. And what that does is essentially codify the practice that we've always implemented, and that is you ask for $100 for tables, we expect it to be spent on tables. You don't get to say, well, I'm going to ask for tables and go back and say, well, I don't see in the budget that you had to spend it on tables, therefore I could spend it on chairs. And what this does is codify the practice that we've all agreed over the years, and we've enforced it. And then it gets enforced through what's called the Chapter 17 reconciliation process, so that the agencies then, when they come back at the end of the fiscal years, whether they get that money back or forward or what account it goes into is regulated by the auditors and the budget staff who look at this. But it's a codification of a practice that recognizes that we are in the exception budgeting process and that the requests for those exceptions are, in fact, the constraints for spending. I'd stand for questions, Mr. Chairman.
Further discussion, Senator Rothfuss.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I have a few questions for clarification and trying to understand from the good president the details of how this would operate. With regard to the spending policy amount, we direct the spending policy amount to the general fund. That does show up on the balance sheet. That can be used for appropriation. That can be used for balancing the budget. If this legislation is enacted, it indicates the spending policy reserve account is not available for either of the two corpuses, not available for use in balancing the budget. Under a circumstance, however, where the spending policy amount falls short, we don't have sufficient revenue to fill the entire spending policy amount, then we're taking the spending policy reserve account, a certain portion of it, and adding that to the SPA. So I'm moving SPRA money to the SPA to fill the SPA under that circumstance. Now, once I've filled up the SPA account, as I understand it, that's directed to the general fund still. So I see a little bit of discord in how this would be written, because I'm taking SPRA funds to fill the SPA to balance the budget, where this is saying that we are not allowed to use those SPRA funds, or the governor's not allowed to propose to use those funds to balance the budget. Is that what's intended, or is it simply the SPRA account balance after the SPA is filled that is not allowed to be used to balance the budget? I'll stop there. I have a second question.
Mr. President.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, good question. Now, we are going to, there's another bill following that addresses some of those issues. We'll address those when we get there. This bill does not intend to, nor does it, change the SPRA policy or the SPA policy. And the SPRA policy and the SPA policy, it's actually the spending policy amount and the policy that implements the investment nature of that account, that policy, is more complicated than I just described, because when you get to the issue of what ends up on the golden rod for expenditure is influenced by what is profiled as forecasted revenues. Not the entire SPA may be available, but it may not be forecasted, and you don't address that. Now, as a practical matter, what this amendment says, though, is that the goldenrod, as you see it, has the revenue that has been forecasted by the consensus revenue estimating group, the Craig Group. For those that you don't know, the Craig Group is an ad hoc group created by agreement between the executive branch and the legislative branch. It has no legislative origination. It's just an ad hoc group, where the two bodies have agreed to use a group of experts to give common revenue forecasts so we all work off the same page, because there's really no reason why, without the Craig group, that the governor could have his own forecast and we could have our own forecast. With respect to this bill, what we're saying is that you have to, the governor must provide a balanced budget based upon what is forecasted on this front sheet. And there'll be a little bit more discussion later about how it gets on the front sheet. But what he's not entitled to do is flip over and see some these account balances in the SPRAW account and saying, I want to use the SPRAW money to balance my budget and I'm going to offer more expenditures. But to the minority floor leader's question, we do not alter the policy where SPRAW money may backflow into the general fund. But if it's not profiled on the front sheet, it can't be spent. And the only time, as a practical matter, it's going to be profiled on the front sheet is after the money's been withdrawn back. And we're kind of going to deal with that in a separate bill. But in this case, all we're saying is you have to forecast on the front sheet. You can't go fishing, if you will, for more money in these reserve accounts. They are governed by statute. Now, part of it is we've induced some of this ourselves. When we had disputes with the House in earlier years about whether we should save or spend, we added money into the SPRAW accounts. By doing that, you lift the amount in there, and when new money comes in, it's closer to the tipping level, and it tips more into the permanent trust fund. And the following year, we withdrew some money. It was bad practice. Don't think I'll ever do it again, but it was made sense at the time. Another thing that we did is in order to move forward with the capital renovation, we know that we didn't have enough money all at once, and so we have said we will appropriate $37.5 million a year until we get enough money to build. But we want to launch the construction contract first. Well, at the time that the construction contract is signed, we don't have enough for the full renovation. But by the time we complete it, we'll have, because the project's going to take multiple years, by the time it's completed, we will have, if we honor our commitment to put $37.5 million per fiscal year in, we'll have paid for it. So, to make sure that the contracts are backfilled, we said if we, for current purposes, for signing that contract, we will encumber up to $112 million in the SPRAW to backfill the capital construction. We do not intend to ever reach into there. We intend to appropriate it, but because construction contracts can't be signed unless the money's there. Again, if we were to do it again, I wouldn't do it out of the SPRAW account. It would be more appropriate to go to the LISRA account, the rainy day account, for that backfill. But it's been done. When I'm gone, don't do it again. But I think that's a long answer, but that's why the controversy gets. And part of this, folks, is these accounts are all relatively new in the sense of the last 15, 20 years, and we've developed some practices. It's time to codify these and have more discipline with respect to how they're used. And I think this is the way to do it so that you don't have to have folks reminding you why you don't do these things. We're actually codifying the discipline of managing these accounts correctly.
Mr. Minority Floor Leader.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My second question was with regard to page 5, the new D provision about the budget narratives. I assume that this isn't going to interfere with or influence the B-11 process in any way, so we have the same statutes in place that would govern that in case there's a desire to shift those budgets.
Mr. President. Chairman, the minority floor leader is correct. There is a process called B-11. It's after a form called B-11 that allows agencies to request authority from the governor to move limited amounts of funds among their series codes, and sometimes some are authorizations between agencies. Some authorization from one object series to another, and Incidentally, that B-11 authority, when we created that to provide the governor some flexibility while we're out of session to deal with emergencies and to address changes so we don't have to reconvene ourselves every time that we need to come in and adjust. Now, the first time that we, if you go way back in history, that general flex authority in our budget was created in part when the legislature passed a 5% reduction in the budget and went home and then gave the governor flex authority at that time to decide where to go in his agencies to find that flex reduction.
Senator Meyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, the question I have is what I'd call kind of a dilution in the statutory reserve or 5%. I recall years ago when the budget reserve amount was proportionally a lot smaller to the general fund than it is today, where today it's approximately a third of the total budget, and the general fund is only two-thirds of the total budget. And if I do a little bit of math and look at the 109 divided by the 3668, basically we've got a 3% budget reserve statute as far as reserves rather than a 5% for the total budget. And my concern is that perhaps at some point in time we need to start taking into account the budget reserve revenue in proportion to the general fund revenue, and maybe either make it 5% of the total budget or bump that up a little bit. And so I'd like to have a little discussion on that. And I don't think it's something that's an emergency, but at some point in time, 3% isn't 5%. You got to realize why we wanted the 5% in the first place.
Mr. President.
Mr. Chairman, the discussion that's what we're talking about is there are three accounts that we've been talking about. We have the statutory reserve, the budget reserve account, and we have the general fund. So if you have your goldenrod out, you turn over to page 2, and there you have the general fund profile, and you have the estimated revenues, and you have the appropriations coming out of it. Now, if you flip the sheet to page 3, you'll see the budget reserve account, and it has revenues coming in, and it has expenditures coming out. Now, when the budget reserve account was originally constructed, the idea was is that your reoccurring revenues would go into the general fund, and if you had one-time revenues, that they would go in the budget reserve account. So we were trying to keep in mind that if you're appropriating ongoing monies, you would appropriate them out of the general fund. And if you appropriated one-time monies, they would come out of the budget reserve account. So that if you have so now then separately, on the front page, you have the statutory reserve. Now, that's not an account. It's just the reserve that's kept in it's actually in the general fund, but it's the reserve of 5% of the general fund revenues. So what our colleague from Goshen County is saying is that perhaps that statutory reserve should not be 5% of the general funds, rather it should be 5% of the general fund income plus the budget reserve income. That's a separate policy, and it's not affected by this amendment. Now, that gets you back to the question of what is the purpose of the statutory reserve. And the idea of the statutory reserve is it's an amount sufficient so you can write your checks. We have sufficient liquidity that in the other accounts that we've never had a check writing problem because, for example, there's $2 billion sitting in the legislative stabilization reserve account, so that
The liquidity is there to write all of our checks, and the treasurer just needs, when the treasurer is managing the funds, the treasurer looks at all the liquid funds, looks at the appropriations and the income, but has to make sure there's a liquid amount that the out of their investments that they can pay warrants and pay for services on a monthly basis. If you did not have the legislative stabilization reserve account or these other liquid accounts, there might come a time where the treasurer comes in to make a large payment and there's no money in the account. And that's happened not in our lifetimes, but it did happen back in, it probably goes back to Governor Hathaway when they didn't have enough money to write checks. Now, in this case, if that event were to happen, the treasurer has borrowing authority where you can actually borrow against a variety of accounts. But we've not had that phenomena. We used to have it more frequently with the school foundation program account because those revenues do come in at odd times, and we were advancing the payments to school districts. There was a time where we actually floated bonds in order to meet our cash flow. But from a cash flow point of view, I think we've proven that $109 million does the trick. If you believe that you're trying to build a reserve account, that's a different discussion. But this does not affect that.
Senator Scott.
Mr. Chairman, my question relates to the new language on bottom of page 5, top of page 6, and trying to figure out what the effect of that language is. And, Mr. Chairman, let me give a hypothetical example that you may well recognize as based on what actually happened one time considerable back in the past. Suppose an agency proposes in its budget, and the governor approves and sends forward, they use a large truck in their functions. They need a new one, they think. And they come forward saying, we want $50,000 for that. The JAC says, no, you get $5,000 to fix it. We defeat an amendment on the floor here to change it back to $50,000, and so the JAC recommendation is sustained. But the agency has, say, they've gotten their budget, $5,000 to repair the old truck. They have a support line item, I forget what you call it, 200 series, something like that, where you've got travel and office supplies and gasoline for the truck and all that sort of thing, and it's $200,000, and we go home, and they say, heck, we got enough money in there, we'll add $45,000 of that to the $5,000 that was appropriated, we'll go buy our new truck. You know, we aren't cheap. And they go do it. What are the sanctions under current law against a practice like that, which actually happened? And what are the sanctions with this new language? Now, I know in either case, one of the potential sanctions is the wrath of the Appropriations Committee if they find out. But what are the formal sanctions? How do we prevent that kind of behavior?
Mr. President.
Mr. Chairman, in the appropriation process, there's two elements. One is an authorization to expend, and one is the appropriation of the funds to meet that authorization. So, there are times where the Appropriations Committee will say, you're authorized to go buy the truck, but we're not going to provide you the funds. You find the funds internally. Now, if that is the recommendation of JAC that's documented in the hearing, then at the end of the day, the agency can do that. They are limited to where they can go to flex. And what we have done, is the agency budgets, you have object series. Now, what we have said is you cannot flex out of your 100 series, which is the labor component. But we do allow other flexing. And, for example, 6 and 900 might be your contract series where you contract with third parties. If you don't use all that money, then you can go to the governor and say, we were authorized to buy this truck. We have no funds. We want you to B-11, authorized through the B-11, the process of moving those funds over to there. And as long as the authorization was there and the funds are available, then the flex authority that exists and the B-11 authorization will allow them to fill that pot. However, if the GAEC says you are not authorized to buy the truck and we deny that, then you have no authorization and you cannot use the B-11 process to go out and buy something that is not authorized. That would be a misappropriation of funds for which there is a series of statutes, and we actually beefed it up in the last few years, but that would constitute a misappropriation. And what the point of this amendment is to say that the agency request, the budget request, and the action taken by JAC, which are recorded, all the JAC meetings are recorded. Those mean something. And that the, in this case, the state auditor could go back and document that said you had no authorization. If you bought something without authorization, that's a misappropriation of funds. Now, with respect to the way the budget works, is the checks are also should be reviewed by the audit team, which is in A&I, and they should catch that and say, you're not authorized to make that expense because you have no authorization. I hope that answers the question.
Senator Scott.
Mr. Chairman. It does not. Mr. Chairman, I have looked for misappropriation of funds language. I have found there is a provision, quite old, and it's a relatively minor one, but there is a sanction if you totally overspend a budget. But where you spend within a budget in a way other than what we intended, I have been unable to find any statute that provides a sanction for that behavior. And if there is such, I would sure appreciate some help in that, because I think we've got a hole in our budgeting process. I do have some reservations about the Appropriations Committee as opposed to the legislature as a whole deciding some of these issues. But that's a separate issue. I've been unable to find any effective misappropriation statute. Frankly, Mr. Chairman brought a bill a couple of years ago that did not pass, trying to provide that. It came to grief over in the other House. But I've been unable to find it. So would appreciate knowing if what such are, because I think a fair amount of what we do and fight over and debate in the budget, the agencies then go do as they please once we go home.
Mr. President.
Mr. Chairman, I will investigate that further tonight. It may be that our colleague from Casper has refreshed my memory that bill did not go through. But I'll look into that. Having said all that, this is an improvement in that it codifies what is our practice, and it may be that an appropriate interim study is to go back and revisit the issue. But let me look at that this evening, and I'll report on it tomorrow.
Any further discussion? Question being called. All those in favor of Senator Ross's motion that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report, it do so with a favorable recommendation on Senate File 141, say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. Senate File 141 has passed Committee of the Whole. The next bill for our consideration is Senate File 146. The reading clerk will read the bill.
Senate File 146, Spending Policy Amendment, sponsored by Senator Nicholas. It was referred to Committee Number 2, Appropriation. Reports back with a favorable recommendation that it do pass. Aye, Senators Hastert, Perkins, Ross, Wasserberger, excuse, Senator Burns, Senator Ross, Chairman.
You've heard the reading of the bill. What's your pleasure, Senator Ross?
Mr. Chairman, I move that when the committee of the whole rise and report, it do so with a due pass recommendation on Senate File 146, Spending Policy Amendments, and I again yield the floor to the President of the Senate.
Mr. President.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, this bill does a number of things. And to have a good discussion, I kind of got to start with the definition and sort of my definition, if you will, of three pretty salient terms. First of all, we have forecasted revenue. Forecasted revenue is revenue that is forecasted by the Craig Group, and it's profiled. We have the term profiling, and profiled revenue, revenue is profiled after it's forecasted, and the Craig Group determines that the money will arrive, and the profiling is an event that really takes place by our staff when they create the goldenrod. So that's profiled on the goldrod. And we have another term that I want to talk about, and that is anticipated revenues. And anticipated revenues may be those that we believe that we're going to receive, but they're not forecasted by the Craig Group. And those anticipated revenues may not appear on the goldenrod. With that in mind, what this does is address the spending policy amounts that we were describing earlier. And there is a spending policy amount, a policy for the Permanent Mineral Trust Fund as well as the Common School Permanent Land Fund. But if you hand it out to you, I hope you all have it by now, is this comes out of your data book. So you get a fiscal data book, and you can download it on the Internet. But when you look at the spending policy, this is, again, the investment policy that we were just describing. So you have the revenues from your Permanent Mineral Trust Fund, the investment earnings go into the general fund. And we set an investment policy that we will spend 5% of the average value of the corpus for the prior five-year average. That's called the spending policy amount. And then anything over that tips into the reserve account. That's your SPRAW account. And you can backfill the SPA amount if it's less than your 5% spending policy amount, and the excess goes back into the corpus above the SPA amount for inflation proofing. Now, in general, this is the program that was designed after the Yale Trust, and what it does is ensure that you set a statutory policy that we think we're going to make on balance 5%. If you make more than 5%, you put it into your SPA, your reserve account. If you make less than 5%, you can withdraw from the reserve account, but your total withdrawals plus your income cannot exceed 5%. And then on phenomenal years, you generate excess revenue, you build the reserve account until the tipping point, which is $190 million. When you exceed that, it goes back into the corpus to inflation-proof the corpus, because if you don't do that, you will, 20 years from now or 100 years from now, the value of your trust fund is less because of inflation. Now, this was the policy that was set up by Representative then Treasurer Lummis when the estate decided to allow the treasurer to invest in equities. Before that time, all investments were in fixed income. Now, here's the issue that we didn't really contemplate at the beginning of that time. This spending policy works if you look at it on an individual fiscal year. So let's assume, for example, that 5% of your revenues off the permanent mineral trust fund is $300 million. That's your spending policy reserve. Now, let's suppose the Treasurer believes that your fixed income is going to be about $150 million. But the Treasurer is unwilling to forecast capital gains because the market's volatile. And he says, I don't want you forecasting that and building it into your budget. So the Treasurer goes to the Cray Group and says, I'll consent and work with you to profile the fixed income, which is your $150 million. But the $150 million, I anticipate we're going to get it. But I don't want you budgeting and spending it until I actually sell stocks and have capital gains, and I make sure we don't have a stock market crash. Perfectly reasonable advice. But that's $150 million that we anticipate receiving, but we're not forecasting it. So under that scenario, the $150 million gets forecasted on the green sheet or on the front of your goldenrod. The anticipated but unforecasted $150 million, the question is, well, since we have the SPRAW account, why can't we forecast the 150? Well, here's the problem. The Treasurer is actually forecasting for 2 years because it's a biennial budget. And if he forecasts 2.5% income each of the 2 years, the hole, if you will, is $150 million for fiscal year one and $150 million for fiscal year two. That's $300 million. Your SPRAW account doesn't have $300 million. So if you're in the Cray Group and you say, well, I want to forecast more revenue, the Cray Group says, well, the people that put this sheet together says, I'm not prepared to put money on this sheet that is not forecasted by the Treasurer's office. And I'm not willing to forecast a dipping into the SPRAW account until the money's actually moved and you have a two-year aspect to that issue. And so the SPRAW is built on a fiscal year, and we budget on 2 years. Now you say, well, on the second year of the biennium, maybe you could fudge. Now you have now you've also have the terms that we've described as forecasting capital gains. The purpose of the SPAW is so you don't forecast capital gains. Rather, you forecast a steady income policy. So the next thing that we've done is, and historically said, that's fine. We had a lot of revenues in the early 2000s, and we told the Treasurer, don't worry about forecasting capital gains. Don't worry. And we told our staff and the Cray Group, do not worry about profiling those amounts. And we always had more revenue and things were going fine. And then we put into the budget sweeps. And the reason we put in the sweeps is because we wanted to build the rainy day accounts and some other things. What do the sweeps hit? And now the sweeps, when you're into the budget, the sweeps take excess revenue that is above your forecasted revenue that was not appropriated. So, and usually, in this case, this year, you'll see in your budget, there's about $40 million worth of natural gas revenues that's income above the Cray projections, and that money would have been swept to the LISRA, the rainy day account, but we didn't have a need to do it. Or actually, it's being captured. Now, the other area is that this $150 million that is anticipated, since it's not profiled, it is recognized by it's actually realized by the Treasurer when the capital gains are sold. It's recognized by the Treasurer's office in the flow sheets at the end of the fiscal year. Now, the end of the fiscal year is why we're out of session. And so then the sweeps come in and they sweep that anticipated but unforecasted and not profiled revenues into the LISRA account. So what do we do? How do we go forward and how do we address these issues? The sweeps had a purpose. We don't want to entirely get rid of them. We want to get out of the practice of using the words unforecasted capital gains. We just get out of that practice. So here's what we're proposing. In general terms, what we're saying is the first 2.5% of all the investment earnings that come off of the fund, which generally looks about like your fixed income forecast, that will be earmarked to stay in the general fund just as it's been doing. So actually last year I think we forecasted 2.1%. So about the first 2.5% is earmarked to stay in the general fund. The second 1.25%, the next dollars received, when they're received, we're not going to forecast them, but we anticipate them. When they receive, they will be earmarked to go into the Legislative Stabilization Reserve account, so we have some funds replenishing that and building that account. And then the final 1.25% will go into the Strategic Investment Policy account, what we're calling the SIPA account, from which we've been engaging in the practice of funding one-time projects, but the money will arrive in the SIPA. Now, what this will do is send these dollars will no longer then be picked up by the sweep. Rather, in advance, we are directing that the income be earmarked to these various accounts. They will not get profiled until they actually arrive or they're forecasted by the Craig Group. So going through the bill, at page 2, the first thing that we do, we have to define these accounts statutorily because some of these accounts, including the LISRA account and the SIP account, those were created in budgets. That's not unusual. You can create a budget can create a new account into which money goes. But in order to direct these funds, we have to create statutory accounts. So we create the LISRA account. The SIP account is created statutorily. And you'll recall that last biennium we created a school foundation program reserve account. That's the equivalent of the LISRA account, the rainy day account, for the school foundation account. There's $100 million, I believe, forecast to be appropriated into that. Then you flip. We now talk about the distribution of funds. So you begin with the federal mineral royalty dollars that are above the earmarked. These are the dollars that are earmarked into the school foundation program account. So we have to bring in the old language to say we're modifying that that flow, the earmarking from the revenues, and we'll talk about in a moment where the actual changes. But we had to bring in the above the cap earmark to re-earmark some of these revenues. Investment, then you turn over to page 6. Now you're into the salient language beginning at the bottom of page 5. So we have 2.5%. The first is going into the, I need to back up. So that the way this has worked is that we say the entire 5% SPA goes into the general fund except that 1.25%, that's from lines 21 through 23 on page 6, going over the top of page 7, that's the 1.25% going into the Legislative Stabilization Reserve account. And then in the next paragraph, we have 1.25% going into the Strategic Investment Projects account. Now, folks, these accounts will fill up in these orders. If you wanted to flip them, you could. You could say, well, let's fill the SIP account first and the LISRA's last to fill. That's a policy decision that we can make, and that's if you wanted to flip it, that's where you would look. And then down at lines 15 through 18, this is the when the dollars actually arrive in the account, and they're to be transferred as after the end of the fiscal year, but no later than 90 days. So that's oftentimes the treasurer will not make the transfers until they do the book balancing, but we're saying make sure you do it by the 90 days. Now, beginning at line 20 on the bottom of 7, we go back to the school foundation reserve account, and we're saying here that 3% will be stayed in the school foundation program account, and 2% will move into the common school permanent land, or excuse me, the school foundation. I said that wrong. 3% stays in the foundation account, and 2% actually gets earmarked for the foundation reserve accounts. Now, as we go through the process of planning, folks, these reserve accounts do need to have continuous replenishment. Now, we'll be talking over the next course of the next year about what the policy is when we go into a reserve account. How do we take much money out? That's a long-term policy, but in the quick time, or the immediately, what this does is it earmarks these revenues so that we're actually planning for their distribution, and they will not get picked up any longer in the sweeps. So they go to the accounts for which they're earmarked, and they aren't just picked up randomly by a sweep. And so we kind of know where the monies are going, and we'll know when they land. They won't always be profiled, because they don't get profiled unless they're forecasted. And then after they arrive, they will get profiled. But you'll see that even in this budget, we can appropriate and say, look, if these funds do arrive, then you can appropriate to these one-time projects. So the couple benefits. One is it gets us in the discipline of earmarking these funds. One. Two, from the investment earnings, it says let's park some of it for current uses in the general fund, some for your rainy day account, and some for one-time projects. That means that there will always be monies profiled for one-time projects. If you put it all in the general fund, I submit to you within a few years, operating expenses will essentially soak up those monies, and you'll have no one-time monies for projects. I think at that point, Mr. Chairman, I'll stand for questions.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. A similar question to the one I had before. I understand the concept for the distribution of the SPA, but I just want to verify that this one doesn't appear to be changing the relationship once again between the SPRA and the SPA, so I would have an expectation that if we had a shortfall of revenues in 1 year where we did not reach the SPA amount of the full 5%, that we would reach into the SPRA to backfill the SPA and get up to the 5% per our usual policy. I just want to verify that that would still take place. And then a follow-up question to that, then, if we are going with a continuation of that policy where we're using the SPRA to equilibrate over time the SPA, is there really a significant need for that order of operations between filling the LISRA first and then the SIPA? It seems to me like since it is our spending policy amount, we're basically always going to fill that coffer unless we really achieve a problem where we don't have any funds available in the SPRA. So maybe I'm missing something, or if I am understanding it, I'd appreciate the clarification.
Mr. Chairman, I've got to recheck because my mind's going a couple different directions on with respect to the interrelationship between the SPRA and the backfill. So the issue is if you're if we do not receive the entire 5% revenue, or if it's total, let me restate that, if the general fund does not receive a total of 5% over the course of the fiscal year, does money flow backwards? I believe the answer, the first answer is this bill does not address that at all. Now the question is what is the current policy? I believe the current policy is that the statute provides for money flowing backwards, but there may be a suspension of that flow back in the budget. But I'm going to stop there because I have to go back and refresh my recollection on that. But the actual answer to your question is this does not address or change the spending policy. It only says with respect to the income from that is the 5% SPA account, it gets earmarked to the three different accounts, and we're going to fill them in order of the general fund first, LISRA second, SIPA third.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. And just a couple of points for the members of the Senate. To me, the significant points of this bill are, first of all, we say that we're going to capture the 2.5%. You know, before it's been anywhere from 2 and sometimes with almost up to 5 years ago when you got good rate of return on short-term money. It's only what the Treasurer can provide you, but we're putting into statute we want to shoot for the 2.5. Then the other part of that, the other 2.5, which could be called anticipated but not realized, and their capital gains, and they're not profiled. What you see is now we're going into there and saying, okay, when those do come and show up, and they have the last couple of years, they've been there, when they show up, we're now earmarking those to go to the two places we're talking about, 1.25% to LISRA, 1.25% will go to the SIPA account. So that's a difference in our policy now. In our policy now, and one of the main reasons that we've seen our LISRA go up so much in the last 2 or 3 years is because the way it flows, when we come to a fiscal year end, the money there is tips and it goes into LISRA. So the reason the LISRA's gone up is because of those capitalized gains when they're finally realized, and they're realized in a timing issue, but typically they would be at the end of the fiscal year, then they roll into LISRA, and that's why LISRA has increased so much. What we're doing now is we're taking part of that away from the automatic roll into LISRA, if you will, goes to SIPA, and really, Mr. Chairman, what that does is that puts money on the table, quite frankly, for us to prioritize and use for future projects.
Further discussion, Senator Von Flattern.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the sponsor, I just want to make sure I understand the common schools public land funds. It says, that are we going to actually get in the way of the school foundation program by taking only 3% to the common schools and then 2% to the reserve account and then backfill should it need to be? That's what I'm reading the fiscal note, and it says of the 5% spending policy, the first 3% would flow to the foundation program account and the next 2% would go to the reserve account. So are we shorting the school foundation, or are we just putting it aside, but yet once it hits 75%, it would then go back into corpus so the foundation program wouldn't see it? I'm not sure how that works, and I'm just confused that we're subtracting anything.
Mr. President.
Mr. Chairman, the effect of this will be, so the school foundation program account would receive the entire 4-5%, but it would not, if you look at page 4 of your goldenrod, in those revenues there will be forecasted the fixed income. You won't see it there. It's embedded in the income. Now, throughout the year, if the when you come back next year, if there was more than 2.5%, it will have gone into the school foundation program account when we're gone. Now, if that happens, then because we have a minimum balance and we have a sweep, see the $100 million of the minimum balance? So the first sweep you see down on the transfer, you should see a transfer there that transfers that down to the school CAFCON account, and then you have a transfer there to the holding account. And then you'll recall what we did with respect to the school foundation account is that the primary funds coming into the foundation account are the funds from federal mineral royalties, the earmarks. We discovered that we had appropriated them years ago based upon the then revenues. Our revenues went up. We identified that, and we were looking at maybe reducing those earmarks. The education committee went ballistic. And then we realized it was over earmarked, and you recall that that's how we funded the Hathaway scholarship. We took what I call the Hathaway spread out. When the Hathaway and the higher end education endowment obligations were fulfilled, about that time we were also losing Coley's bonuses that were building our schools. So we took what is the Hathaway differential and we took it out of this account and started dropping it down into the school capital construction account. And then we said, you know, we have not made much of an investment into the corpus of the common school permanent land fund since the beginning of statehood. So if we have excess revenues after school capital construction, we'll move it down to the permanent land fund holding account. We keep it there until it hits a tipping, and some money will tip back into the corpus of the common school permanent land fund. What will happen with this bill is the amounts that are flowing down in those tips will be reduced. Not off the goldenrod, but in practice, because these are funds that are anticipated but not forecasted. So that if we, in the end, right now the beginning balance is $475 million. If, for example, $100 million were scalped on, if we had had this bill in a year ago, it may have been that that $100 million would have been scalped from there and taken over to the School Foundation Program Reserve Account, which is over on page, top of page 5. So what will happen with the implementation of this policy is there will be less monies flowing down on page 4 that goes finally into the holding account and tipping out, and more money being directed into that reserve account, which is on page 5, and it's just a policy decision that that's a reserve account that we should be building. And for those of you who don't know, if you want to know what a complicated or a hard budget is, when we came down in the late 90s, the first thing we had to do was take general fund to pay for schools. And when you got when your first check out of your checkbook is $150 to $100 million to fund schools, that's when you start saying, this is no fun. And when we start looking at the out years, the question is will the income off of that are earmarked to these accounts be sufficient to pay for all of our school operations? We should be building a reserve account for that that account as well. So last year in the budgets, the JAC created the reserve account, funded it with $100 million. You'll recall that some came from general fund, $60 million, some was SIPA, but there's no continuous money going in here. With the passage of this bill, there will be 2% of the revenues, which are generally not forecasted, but they're anticipated, and they'll start to populate this account and create a reserve.
Any further discussion? Seeing none, you ready for the question? All those in favor of Senator Ross's motion that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report, it do so with a favorable recommendation on Senate File 146, please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. Senate File 146 is passed Committee of the Whole. Mr. Majority Floor Leader.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move the Committee of the Whole rise and report.
You've heard the motion. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, motion passes. Mr. President.
Let's see, do we have any reports? No reports from the House, no standing committee reports. That clears the desk?
No, got to do the
committee. Oh, we do. I always forget that. Would the reading clerk please read the Committee of the Whole report?
Mr. President, your Committee of the Whole, having had under consideration bills on general file, begs leave to report as follows. Senate File 123, do pass. Senate File 110, do pass amended. Senate File 137, do pass. Senate File 84, do pass. Senate File 102, do pass amended. Senate File 142, do pass amended. Senate File 141, do pass. Senate File 146, do pass. Senator Hastert, Chairman.
Chairman Hastert.
Mr. President, I move for adoption of the Committee of the Whole report.
You've heard the motion. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. The Committee of the Whole report has been adopted. And now, does that clear the desk? Mr. Majority Floor Leader, that does clear the desk.
Mr. President, I move that the Senate stand adjourned until 10 a.m. tomorrow, Wednesday, February 4th.
Messages. Announcements. Senator Geis.
Mr. Chair, President, your committee number 5, Agriculture, Public Land and Water Resources, will meet about 4 o'clock. Is that right? Yeah. About 4 o'clock up in S-15, and we'll take up Senate File 133, Bighorn Sheep Relocation, and Senate File 134, Bighorn Sheep Plan.
Senator Scott.
Mr. President, your committee number 10, Labor, Health, and Social Services, will meet tomorrow morning at 8 a.m. in the normal committee room. We're going to deal with Senate File 118, Personal Opportunity with Employment Responsibilities, and we're going to complete our work on Senate File 145 in the hospitals that we started the other day.
Mr. Majority Floor Leader.
Thank you, Mr. President. Mr. President, it's your committee number 12, Rules. We'll meet tomorrow, Wednesday, February 4th, upon adjournment in room S-11 to consider the following Senate Joint Resolution. Senate Joint Resolution 4, Constitutional Convention.
Senator Ross.
Thank you, Mr. President. Your committee number 2, Appropriations, will meet upon the noon recess tomorrow in room S-11 over by the Smoking Lounge to consider the following re-referrals. Senate File 95, Speed Limits. Senate File 122, 2020, or Vision 2020. And Senate File 127, Transportation and Education Revenue Distribution. We'll probably take up Senate File 127 first to accommodate the Chairman of Transportation.
Senator Christensen.
Thank you, Mr. President. Your Judiciary Committee number 1 will meet Wednesday morning at 8 a.m. Room S-1 to consider the following bills, Senate File 120, Uniform Interstate Family Support Act, and Senate File 136, Expedited EMT Licensing.
Senator Von Flatern.
Thank you, Mr. President. Your hardworking Committee number 9, Minerals and Economic Development, will meet about 20 minutes after noon recess, Room S-18. To discuss Senate File 131, a continuation of that minimum wage staged increase, Senate File 121, career and technical training grants, Senate File 138, small business innovation research matching funds, Senate File 135, misclassification of employees penalty.
There being no further announcements, you've heard the motion. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. The Senate shall stand adjourned until 10 a.m. Wednesday, February 4th.